YY.
I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama looked like he could not get out of town fast enough at his press conference right before Christmas last week. The first year of his second term has been filled with political drama, showdowns, and some disappointments. The website rollout for the Affordable Care Act was a mess, although things have improved in the last few weeks. The NSA surveillance program was criticized by a federal judge, a panel convened by the White House, and some members of Congress. But Congress fared no better this year, maybe even worse. The shutdown fueled the public's mistrust of government. House Speaker John Boehner publicly criticized conservative groups for going too far and using members of the GOP for their own goals. That was after Senator Patty Murray and Representative Paul Ryan negotiated an actual budget that was passed and signed by President Obama. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios as we look back on the year in politics. Robert Costa, formerly National Review's Washington editor, and in January, he'll be joining the Washington Post as a national political reporter. And Robert Costa, congratulations on your new job, and thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty.
You're very welcome. Also with us is James Peterson, and he's Director of Africana Studies, Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University. He's a regular contributor to MSNBC and The Griot. And James Peterson, nice to have you back with us
as well. Good morning, Marty. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you both with us. And I gave you a little bit of a heads up, because I don't normally do this, but I said in the spirit of the season, for you, Robert Costa, what's the good news of this year?
Well, I think you've already mentioned it. After almost living at the U.S. Capitol during the shutdown and seeing government at its worst, to see Paul Ryan and Patty Murray come together at year's end and to pass a budget is a significant achievement for both parties, and I think it is the feel-good story of American politics.
Mm-hmm. I'm up for you, James Peterson.
Yeah, I would echo what Bob's saying. I think that's an important story from the year and an important story as we look into 2014 as well. But I'll take a more personal story as a feel-good story. You know, Marissa Alexander was in jail after firing a shot in her own home that she claims she did to defend herself from her husband, who had been on record as being abusive.
And this was in Florida.
This was in Florida. In fact, the same prosecutor's office that handled the George Zimmerman case is the same prosecutor's office that actually imprisoned her for 20-plus years. And there were different movements, both online and through social media. In fact, Esther Armand led one of those movements. It was called 31 for Marissa Alexander, where they wrote letters. It was a letter mm-hmm. campaign. And that kind of pressure was brought to bear on the state of Florida and on the prosecutor's office, and Marissa Alexander is home right now and is going to have a new trial. And so that to me is a feel-good story, because, you know, I do a lot of work with criminal justice system and the prison industrial complex and all the challenges and the kind of racial bias and class bias that exists in that institution. So Marissa Alexander is a pretty feel-good story for me.
And that was all part of the Stand Your Ground laws.
It was,
Florida as well.
Yes.
To me, I think it's just an interesting phenomenon to look at the number of states that have legalized gay marriage Utah now sort of struggling, I guess, with this particular issue. But as someone who covers Washington, D.C., Robert, are you surprised to see what's happening in the states on this issue?
I'm not surprised to see it, but it's fascinating to see on social issues how Washington isn't really having that conversation right now, that with divided government, fiscal policy can barely be enacted, and social policy and social issues are barely being discussed. But out in the states, there's a major conversation happening. And you see not only purple states and blue states, but red states, as you mentioned, Utah and others, mm-hmm. are moving toward same-sex marriage. And I think you're going to see states continue in 2014 to perhaps move in that direction.
Yeah, I think, you know, marriage equality is another one of the feel-good stories for me of this year and of the last couple of years, because I think for progressives who, you know, want to look at, like, poverty or class issues or look at race or gender, and you see that a lot of walls up along those movements and a lot of regression, particularly in the states, it's actually a sort of shining bright light to see some of this progress. And it's a result of the sort of sea change in public opinion around these issues. There's been good leadership on this, good activism, good political leadership on it, but it's also just people coming to terms with the reality that marriage equality is a civil right that we should no longer be debating and fighting over.
Well, let's talk about some of the difficulties of the year. Robert Costa, I'm back at you. I think Congress passed and Obama signed something like 65 bills this year, which apparently is, I'm not saying it's an all-time low, but it's a low number of bills. I don't know if that's the criterion or criteria to use whether a Congress is productive or not, but what do you think explains, at least compared to the 112th Congress, which passed 231 bills, what explains, do you think, the small number of bills?
Well, conservatives would look at the number of bills
right.
and say the fewer the better.
Right.
But what's interesting is that ever since November 2010 and January 2011, where Republicans took over the U.S. House, President Obama and Republicans have struggled to find common ground. And this has been a story not only of 2013 but of 2012 and 2011. And I think when you're looking ahead right now, both parties are struggling with this question and this issue, expectations for divided government. Republicans really want to see conservative policy enacted. Democrats want to do things like climate change. But in divided government, the reality is your wish list for both parties is going to be very limited. And I think the budget deal is a sign of both parties coming together and realizing they can only do small deals, not grand bargains on any issue. And I think the story of 2013 is not much is going to get passed until both leaderships recognize that divided government only has limited opportunities and you have to pursue them, and anything else is going to be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Obama said 2014 would be a year of action, but it sounds like what you're saying, Robert, is that perhaps it's going to be more of the same.
Well, I mean, we have the Speaker of the House of Representatives, on a program was saying that maybe this Congress needs to be measured by how many laws they repeal, not by how many laws or how much legislation they enact. And a lot of people kind of scoffed at that, but that's a political strategy. And I think conservatives, particularly in the Obama era, really believe that government has gotten out of control. That's very, very difficult for progressives to swallow because we see the cuts in government jobs. We see the sequester now in place for, a year and a half or so. And so I think there are competing ideologies that have, and I think, struggle is an understatement. We have stasis. We have government that really does not work right now. And so I'm not sure if this is divided government in the same sense that it has been over the last few decades. 20, 30 years ago, even in divided government, there seemed to be more room and more space for legislative compromise than there is today.
You agree, Robert?
I think that's right. And I think the president's comment that you mentioned, Marty, is an important one. He does want 2014 to be a year of action. And he knows that since 2011, since Republicans have taken over the House, he has struggled to get things passed. 2009, 2010, major achievements for the president. Since then, not so much. And I think the hiring of John Podesta from the Center for American Progress is a signal that the president wants to do more liberal things, wants to have a bolder agenda in 2014. And he's struggled to have a more progressive agenda. And I think the president also realizes his party is moving slightly to the left. It's not just the president anymore who's a hero. Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts
and
other progressives are really ascending now within the Democratic Party. I think the president's responsive to that strain.
This is a major story for me going into 2014 and into 2016, which is something I've been saying for a long time, that the coalition of voters, the demographics that supported the president's reelection is to the left of the Democratic Party. And Elizabeth Warren is one good indicator of that. Progressives have been trying to push the president. A lot of people called out Tavis Smiley and Cornel West around their push for the president to talk about poverty. What's the president talking about? Poverty and income inequality. Progressives have been screaming that for years. And so the president realizes this, and the ascension of folk like Elizabeth Warren shows that electoral politics have to now meet the sort of political leanings of the Democratic Party. And again, I really feel as if the constituents of the Democratic Party are a little bit more progressive and to the left of the elected leaders of the Democratic Party right now. And there should be some realignment over the next couple of years.
Robin, let me toss something else out here. And when the government was shut down, I think that was the third longest shutdown of government in U.S. history. I remember interviewing a number of economists and saying essentially to them, is Congress good or bad for the economy? And they all said, Congress is bad for the economy because when you shut down government, you hurt people and you hurt the economy. There's going to be another potential, I guess, fight over the debt ceiling, even though the budget was passed, February
7th.
Right. Is this going to be deja vu all over again, do you think?
Well, I think the markets and a lot of Americans are wiping their brow after this budget deal was signed, thinking that now shutdowns are going to be averted because a budget deal has been struck. But come February 7th, there is likely going to be another standoff, and that's the debt ceiling. You remember the debt ceiling, the famous pursuit of a grand bargain in 2011? Well, we have another deadline coming up on February 7th. However, I do not think it's going to be like it was this past year with the debt ceiling. I think Republicans do not have the appetite for a shutdown or a standoff like they did last year because of the political pain involved. And I think they've learned a few lessons from that shutdown, and that includes probably cutting a deal in February.
Well, let me quote John Boehner, who was criticizing some of these conservative groups that he felt were sort of pushing members of his own party to shut down the government. He said, you know, they pushed us to fight this, they pushed us into this fight to defund Obamacare. It wasn't exactly the strategy I had in mind, but if you will recall, the day before the government reopened, one of the people at these groups stood up and said, well, we never really thought it would work. And then Boehner says, are you kidding me? Yeah. I mean, his own frustration with some of these conservative groups.
I mean, I know we're all home for the holidays. I was just home in Yardley, Pennsylvania for Christmas, and a lot of times in families, in a Republican Party, it's like a family's tensions simmer all year, and then there's one moment where it finally overflows, and the family has a disagreement that becomes a little more public. That's what's happening right now in the Republican Party. The private tensions are becoming public. But I think John Boehner's frustration, as he's articulated it, is an important moment because those private tensions have always been there, but he's been almost afraid to articulate them. He's been afraid to confront the Tea Party. Heading into 2014, if we have a speaker who continues to push back against the conservative right, that's going to be helpful to the president as he tries to make things happen in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's going to be some realignment on the right as well, just like there needs to be some a little bit on the left. There'll be some adjustments on the right. And I felt like that was a watershed day, the day that John Boehner
critiqued Harris. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, well, because not only is that good for American politics on the whole, for the leader on the right to essentially reject the influence and the role of big money in politics. I mean, that's a very, very important issue for our political system going forward. To what extent can we insulate our politics and our policies from the overdetermination of some of these kinds of groups? And so that gesture, particularly on the right, I think was a watershed moment and an important moment for the American political process.
And we're almost up in a break here, but can we say the Democrats are one big happy family? I don't
absolutely
think so.
Absolutely not. No. The Democrats, in many ways, are more fragmented than the Republican Party. It doesn't make national news in the same ways, but that rift that I was talking about in the previous segment between progressives who had a lot of hope for this president and were disappointed by the centrist sort of moderated ways, and really some would say center-right ways, in which he's governed over the course of both of his terms at this point. Some of those progressives are just done. There are some that are just done with the Democratic Party and are looking at the Green Party and looking at other options. But I think there has to be that realignment. There are too many, and this is part of the reason why we're never going to get a grand bargain, at least not out of this arrangement of politicals, because there is no grand bargain to be had from the left. There will be no stomaching of changes, significant changes in the social safety net in order to get the kind of tax loopholes eradicated from our system. That's not going to happen. It's not politically viable from the left.
Well, and hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break. And that's James Peterson, the voice you just heard, director of Africana Studies, associate professor of English at Lehigh University. He joins us along with Robert Costa, and next week he'll be joining the Washington Post as a national political reporter. We're talking about the year in politics, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Celebrating 50 years of service in the tri-state area, SCORE, Counselors to America's Small Business, supports WHYY. A partner of the U.S. Small Business Administration, SCORE is a nonprofit agency dedicated to helping entrepreneurs start a business and existing businesses to grow. For information on counseling and seminars, or to volunteer counseling services, online at scorebuckscounty.org or 215-943-8850.
You have the perfect gift for everyone, but what about yourself? Give yourself the gift of a last-minute tax deduction. Support WHYY now to help us end the year on a high note. Whether you give a sustaining gift, have your employer match your gift, donate your car, or make a direct IRA rollover to WHYY, time is running out to make a tax-deductible donation. Explore the many ways to support WHYY. Call 1-888-345-WHYY or visit whyy.org/support.
5 years ago, Brian Hickey left a New Jersey bar and was walking to a close-by train station. He remembers that much.
Skid marks were right about here, and then they found me here.
What followed was an uncertain journey.
Can I tell you that Brian is going to be who he was before this accident? No.
I'm Mike and Scott. Next time on The Pulse, the long road back from traumatic brain injury.
I thought I was talking.
The Pulse, tomorrow morning at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. So what do you think are the high and low points of this year in politics? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Send us a tweet at Marty Moss-Cohen. And again, our guests are James Peterson. He is a regular contributor to MSNBC and The Griot. Robert Costa, for a couple of years, was the Washington editor of National Review and joins the Washington Post in January as a national political reporter. Let me pick up on a couple of things that you wanted to say something, right? You looked like you were just about to say something.
We were just discussing the potential for a grand bargain. I think the way a grand bargain would be structured, should one happen in 2014, would be entitlement reform for revenue. But Democrats now are actually moving more to the left. They don't want to deal on entitlement reform. President Obama has always signaled the willingness to do change CPI, which is how Social Security benefits are calculated. But now Democrats like Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts are looking to expand Social Security. And so you have Democrats moving to the left. They want to not even touch entitlements. And then Republicans, of course, are unwilling to deal on tax rates and any kind of new revenue. So I think you're right. There's not going to be a grand bargain. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you about the fact that something like 1.2 or 3 or 4 million long-term unemployed, 1.3 million, are apparently not going to get their unemployment benefits. This was something that came out of the sequester, but nonetheless, it looks like that will be over for them. There are questions about the future of for recipients of food stamps.
Yeah.
James, does this worry you?
Well, I think the end of unemployment insurance for 1.3 million Americans should worry all of us. I think when you look at the data, it shows that this is not good for the economy in a kind of an absolute sense. There's plenty of studies that show that unemployment insurance does not deter people from seeking jobs and trying to get work. And there's good data that shows that we could lose a couple hundred thousand jobs just from not having that money in the system. You know, one of the things that we don't talk enough about in terms of entitlements is that that money goes back into our economy and sometimes in some really important ways. And unemployment insurance is one of the ways in which we keep people connected to the workplace and keep people connected to their own desires for employment. Many of the folk who are collecting those checks are trying to find new jobs, especially the long-term folk. They're a little bit older in some cases and have different difficulties getting back into the workplace. But when you remove that particular safety net, it has a negative impact because a lot of that money, again, goes into our economy.
What do you think, Robert?
There are two elements right now within the Republican Party and about why they're opposed to extending long-term unemployment. Some, such as Rand Paul of Kentucky, are ideologically opposed from a principled perspective for extending this. They don't think the government should be, from their own perspective, doing this on a long-term basis over and over again. But when you listen more closely to someone like Speaker Boehner, they are right now opposed to extending it. But the reason for this is politics. Republicans like Boehner are willing to consider a bill that comes to the floor. Boehner said that at a recent press conference. But he wants the president to give something up in exchange. It's about political deal-making rather than being principally opposed.
What would Boehner like Obama to give up? Do you know?
Well, spending cuts usually is the first Republican ask. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, you could see some ask on entitlement reform or just some reforms in how much some programs are getting for their spending in 2014.
But it does – I mean, who speaks for poor people in this
country? Exactly.
I mean, I think that's
I think Republicans are struggling with that, right? Because Republicans – from a conservative perspective, do not think the government should be making unemployment, as they would frame it, as an entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, because the president is struggling with Obamacare, he is making a real case on economic inequality.
Yes.
And I think Republicans know that's picking up steam. And so when you see Republicans like Paul Ryan and Senator Mike Lee of Utah, in the last few months, they've made major speeches on poverty.
Yeah.
Now, they're not signaling a lot of willingness to do new spending on poverty programs. So from a policy perspective, let me be clear that they're not doing anything that would be construed as liberal. But they're at least talking about poverty because they know the Democrats are getting some momentum on the issue.
And
so poverty is a big problem in this country.
It's a big problem, 40 million Americans. And that doesn't even account for Americans who dip in and out of poverty. Those are just folk who are below the poverty line right now. And it has to pick up traction because there are a lot of red states where income inequality is really, really pronounced. And so it's an important story. But I love the fact that politicals on both sides of the aisle feel pressure to talk about income inequality. It is long-term much more challenging for this nation than anything like the debt or deficit spending, or even long-term more challenging than the social safety net. The president's pivot towards income inequality is an important political move for access to affordable health care, because at the end of the day, the ACA is about really trying to close some of those income inequality gaps. It's health care that puts a lot of people in the poorhouse. And so that's an important political pivot by the president. And I think it's also important, again, to see political leaders across the aisle have to talk about this. This is something that we should be talking about going forward. It's something we'll see in 2014 as a political issue. I think in 2016, you'll see more presidential candidates say the word poor and talk about poverty than we did in the past two elections put together. And it's warranted. When you look at the data and you look at the growing gap of income inequality and the projections going forward,
it's worrisome.
I mean, in terms of the very stability of the fabric of our society, it's not sustainable for us to have this many people impoverished and a country this wealthy.
Robert, do you think, and you're not here to speak for Republicans at all, but do you think Republicans want the Affordable Care Act to succeed, or they worry that it's going to fail? I mean, in terms of understanding the criticism of the Affordable Care Act, how do you see the Republican Party?
They don't look at the Affordable Care Act like they do Medicare or Social Security. Those are programs that Republicans over the decades have come to accept and come to protect. But the Affordable Care Act, they still think, is in this nascent stage where it can be repealed potentially should Republicans win the Senate and the House in 2014 and maybe even get a Republican president in 2016. So these may be high hopes.
You're chortling there, James.
The thinking is that first of all, they think the problems from the implementation have really saved the party heading into the midterms. Remember, the Republicans were at the 20s or in the teens in the polls after the shutdown. And then suddenly they started to shift back up because of Obamacare's problems. So they're going to continue to hammer it. I don't think they're going to root for it to succeed. But the interesting thing is many Republicans, instead of having this full rally cry for repeal and just talking about repeal, they've privately begun to accept it as settled law. And they want to offer an alternative, but they're not just going to talk about repeal because they know it is the law of the land. And it's going to be very hard to get the root, take out the roots, even if you win back the majority, because a lot of the programs are already being established.
Exactly.
But do you think the president could have or should have done more to sell his signature piece of legislation? Or do you think
I would have rather the president's administration spent more time establishing the federal government's role in the exchanges, particularly through healthcare.gov, as opposed to trying to lobby Republican legislators and lobbying governors and lobbying states to try to get them to set up certain exchanges. It seems to me that, and this is Monday morning quarterbacking, but it seems to me that it's a little bit naive in this political environment for the federal government to believe that in good faith that many of these states would not reject Medicaid, that many of these states would embrace developing their own exchanges. Those exchanges still are the ones that have worked most mm-hmm. efficiently. But the Obama administration spent a lot of time trying to get the state exchanges set up, and maybe some of that time could have been diverted to setting mm-hmm. up healthcare.gov and ensuring that it could handle the scale with which people would approach. But I think that as we move further and further into the era of the ACA, it will become more like Medicare and Social Security, because you have to understand this from both a pragmatic and, I think, an ethical standpoint. We don't want to live in a nation where there's this many people who don't have access to health care. We don't want to live in a nation where insurance companies make determinations about who gets insurance and who doesn't, who can be healthy and who cannot. And the Affordable Care Act, I think, long term will show that its value to our society and to our social contract is fairly indispensable.
What do you think, Robert Costa?
I think the future is yet to be seen on the Affordable Care Act, because the implementation has been a problem for the administration. It's been a problem for Democrats. And this is the president's signature law. I'm just surprised as a journalist that there was not someone fired for the implementation's problems, that the president didn't seem to be prepared, or at least his team didn't seem to be prepared for the political fallout and the administrative fallout of the program's implementation. But that doesn't mean that Republicans should be dancing in the streets. I mean, we are still at an early stage with the Affordable Care Act. It's working out its kinks. And I think you're right, Professor, that eventually it is going to become something that's not only accepted, but it's well-liked by people,
right?
Because it gives them access to health insurance, and
yeah,
especially by those who have never had health insurance.
That's right.
And Republicans do know this. And but they're making more of an argument now about competency than about the actual law.
Right. And the competency argument should be made, but this is comparable. The ACA and the American acceptance of it, because you see these polls that are not so good about it. But think about the polling data versus the sort of sea shift change with respect to marriage equality and LGBT rights, right? Eventually people understood, and a lot of those folk came around by looking at family members or relatives, or you saw a lot of politicos who had relatives or siblings, and that helped to sort of push that sea change. It's the same principle here.
Hmm.
My mom just had a hip replacement, and she's on Medicare, and you love the fact that Medicare is there for folk who really need it, and folk who've worked hard their entire lives. And so I think as those stories start to get out a little bit more and people understand that access to health care is one of the key factors in income inequality and in poverty, I think that coming together with the personal connection stories will help the ACA become a more part of the American political consciousness.
I think we also have learned, and I think I would include myself in this, which is that we have a very complicated system no matter what
we call it.
Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes hard to even know what the system was before and what the system will be under the Affordable mm-hmm. Care Act.
Well, and that's why I think a key moment to watch for in 2014 is if the premiums go up for those
right.
who are participating in the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
And if people start to really think it's not an affordable care,
right.
Then it could be a real problem for the administration. But I think you're right. I think that's the real problem for the administration right now. It's not getting too much blame, and rightfully so, that for all, some of these website problems. But healthcare is such a complicated area.
Right.
And it's odd that an administration that's so known for an effective campaign, for being sleek and having well-designed government in many aspects is just stumbling on its prize law.
Well, the conundrum there was that there were people, they in the administration knew this, they just didn't know how to politically say this. People who have health care policies that don't meet the qualifications of the Affordable Care Act will not have them. Many of those people will pay higher premiums. They're getting better health care,
right.
health care insurance, but there are going to be people that are going to have to pay higher premiums. The question is, how's that going to play out politically?
Let me quickly reintroduce you. We have invited two Washington observers to help us take inventory of the year in politics. We'll be looking ahead to what we might expect in the year 2014. And again, Robert Costa, formerly National Review's Washington editor, and come January he'll be at the Washington Post as a national political reporter. James Peterson, director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University, a regular contributor to MSNBC and The Griot. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We want to know about your highs and lows in the year in politics. We have a tweet from Brendan and he says the low point politically for both Pennsylvania and the nation is the failure to pass any reforms post Sandy Hook shooting. And James Peterson, we're just a year past the horrible massacre in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. A colossal failure of our government not to to pass some modicum of common sense gun safety in the aftermath of that. I hope that people will back away a little bit from the politics of this, because I think there's a lot of blame to go around Washington in terms of how common sense gun safety ideas get framed, the ways in which the NRA is demonized and plays into its own demonization that affects policy and the capacity for policy, particularly in a place like Washington. People need to back away from that a little bit and really try to understand what is going on. The NRA is much more representative of gun manufacturing than it is of actual gun owners. And I think Republicans and Democrats need to understand that and really start to speak to the folk who are the actual gun owners, who 75% of them want to have background checks. That's one important piece that won't solve all of the problems around gun control, doesn't help as much with some of the challenges we see in our cities, but it does help a little bit with mental illness and these sort of mass shootings. That's a good, important political step. But if folk can just step back a little bit from the political machinations of like the NRA and people in Washington, just understand, hey, we need to get something done on this, both as a show, a symbolic show, that we're interested in, we're engaged in one of the serious, most serious challenges, mm-hmm. I think, facing our nation, but then also just to put some practical things in place that might be able to hedge against some of these awful shootings.
Because it is interesting. I mean, even members of the NRA, and I think something like 90% of the public is in support of something like a background check, but even a year or even a couple of weeks after the Sandy shooting, nothing.
I mean, one of the moments that always stick out in my mind from 2013 was at a Capitol Hill restaurant during the gun control debate, and I had breakfast with Senator Pat Toomey, and he was recalling how in the late 90s, when he was a member of the U.S. House from Pennsylvania, he worked with the NRA on a background check legislation, and he couldn't believe that in 2013, that same kind of background check that he worked on with the NRA was now being opposed by the NRA. And I think come 2016, when Toomey's up for re-election, 2013 is going to be an interesting year to recall, because Toomey was the leader, along with Joe Manchin, and a moderate Democrat from West Virginia, of trying to get background checks through. But years and years, decades now, the NRA remains a huge, major force in American politics, of course within Republican politics, but it's also those red state Democrats who are up for re-election in gun-friendly states in 2014. They're also nervous of angering the NRA.
But why are they – I don't understand. Why are they so powerful? Why is the NRA so powerful?
Well,
do you know?
Two reasons. Of course, it's a great lobbyist. They have a lot of money. But the thing is, I've always noticed from covering the country in the 2012 campaign in 2010, is that there really is a Second Amendment culture in many states.
Right.
And it comes down to hunting. It's how people are raised. And that when you grow up in Philadelphia, you don't always sense it everywhere. But across the country, there are major, large regions and pockets where talking about guns is not something that is frivolous or seen as odd. It's part of life. And politicians respond to that. That's why they're reluctant to do much.
But I'm challenging politicians to speak to those people and not the NRA. Get the lobbyists out of they're in the middle right now, the process of politicians speaking to their constituents about Second Amendment culture. And as long as that's the case, then the money will control the debate and control the policy. I think they have to circumnavigate. They have to go around, circumvent rather, the lobbyists and just speak directly to those folk. Mm-hmm. This is not about taking away folks' hunting rights. This is not about removing the responsibility for people who own guns. It's really about enhancing that a little bit. And common sense gun safety is, I think, the thing without which we can't move forward in terms of violence in our culture and school shootings, mental, all the issues that play into it, I think start with that first step, universal background check.
We're almost up in a break here, but Robert, I believe that the Senate passed an immigration bill. It looks like it sort of is sitting there in the House. Do you think immigration reform, whatever form it takes in, is something that might happen next year?
I'm not so sure that the House will conference with the Senate and try to reconcile the Senate's bill with some version of the House's immigration policy. But I think Republicans do know that in 2014 they have to address immigration. It's a key issue, and a lot of groups are interested in seeing some Republican action. But look for Republicans to push piecemeal policies in the House and maybe try to get something together in the Senate. But they're not going to do the broad comprehensive bill like that was passed by Schumer and Rubio.
But is that because 2014 is an election year, and when there's an election year, you need to make sure you have a diverse voting base?
Exactly. I think Republicans need to throw something out there on immigration, but they're not going to. The interesting thing is John Boehner, though, seems very interested in getting something done in immigration.
He does.
Just hired a major policy staffer to help him get something through. But he knows that so many conservatives have problems with the Senate's bill, so a comprehensive package is unlikely. But look for something like the DREAM Act. That Eric Cantor and John Boehner seem supportive of something like that.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Robert Costa, joins us along with James Peterson. We're talking about politics. This year in politics, looking ahead to 2014 as well. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us, Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
supporting WHYY, Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Downingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a long-standing tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides personal care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, and independent living. A specially designed personal care neighborhood staffed with licensed nurses provides assistance with daily tasks to help residents remain as independent as possible. More at simpsonmeadows.org.
Few reporters know Washington like NPR's Cokie Roberts. Hi, I'm Dave Davies, inviting you to join me for a timely and in-depth discussion I'll be hosting with Cokie at the Merriam Theater Thursday, January 23rd. Call 1-888-345-9499 and make a $10 a month sustaining membership gift to WHYY. We'll send you two tickets to this event as our way of saying thanks. Again, that's 1-888-345-9499 to make your sustaining contribution and reserve your seats now. Thanks.
It's Listener's Choice Week on Fresh Air, featuring favorite interviews from 2013 we're sure you would have chosen had we asked. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, who co-wrote Superbad. And this year's End of the World satire, This is the End. And we listen back to our interview with astronaut Chris Hadfield about his 6 months in space. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. I'm picking the brains of Robert Costa. He was a Washington editor for National Review for about 4 years, and come January, he'll be joining the Washington Post as a national political reporter. Also with us, James Peterson, director of Africana Studies, also associate professor of English at Lehigh University, a regular contributor to MSNBC and The Griot. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet me at Marty Moss Cohen. So let's talk about the NSA. And I think last week on Monday, a judge called it Orwellian and probably unconstitutional. A panel that was really picked by the White House came up with 46 recommendations, pretty critical of the program. And Edward Snowden, we keep learning more things from him about this particular program. I'd just be curious, James, about what you think is going on here.
I think that Snowden and Greenwald together have exposed things about the NSA that many people in the American public did not know, but those of us who've been following politics since the Bush administration, at least, have seen some of these things unraveling a little bit more slowly. I think the president's administration was a little bit shocked, obviously, by the exposure and maybe not aware of the pervasive nature of NSA surveillance. And so I think it's an important story. I think that the administration has got to continue to be transparent on it. It's got to continue to evaluate it. And I think the pressure from private companies like Google and Facebook that will continue to be applied in 2014 will help us to reel some of it in. But I also just want to make the case for the fact that surveillance is something that impacts people based upon like class, race, and region as well. And a lot of scholars like Imani Perry and More Beautiful, More Terrible talk about physical surveillance, the ways in which poor people are surveilled, the ways in which people of color are surveilled by the criminal justice system, like a more physical surveillance, like stop and frisk. And I think that the people who are interested in addressing those types of surveillance have got to intersect with those folk who are really on fire right now with the kind of digital surveillance that we're seeing. And I think that kind of movement going forward is what will help to address those issues across that spectrum.
Do you think things are shifting in Washington, Robert, as it relates to NSA?
Well, when you see this panel's report and the president addressed it at his final press conference of the year, he seemed to take it seriously. He said he's going to review it over vacation in Hawaii. And because I think the president knows that now the tides of American politics are not so much pro-war, anti-war like it was during the Bush administration, but it's really about being libertarian or a more hawkish perspective on national security. And I think in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, there are large concerns growing about the NSA. And what a bad year for the NSA. I mean, you saw them on 60 Minutes when they were interviewed by John Miller try to explain their position, but you really have a lot of raised eyebrows around the country about all this so-called metadata being collected. And even if it's not being used, it is being collected and archived. And I think you're right. It's unsafe. unsettling to a lot of people. Mm. And politicians, I think, in 2014 will be responsive.
And I guess just the idea, even though Obama said, and it doesn't appear that a lot of people have been, you know, yanked out of their homes or, you know, dragged
right.
off.
But when you unite the concerns of surveillance across class and across race and across physical versus digital surveillance, that is going to be an important movement. And I think it's important in terms of checking our government, but also important in terms of protecting the liberties. And I agree with Robert here that the hawks, I think, are losing that ideological battle, that people are less interested in American intervention abroad. That's why there's a little bit more tolerance for drone policy than you would imagine, particularly from people who are in the Democratic Party. People are less interested in the kind of big government that's Orwellian. We can have a conversation about government in terms of social safety net, but there's a lot more consensus around not wanting the government to make decisions or not wanting to have the government to have the capacity to spy on individuals, even though that's not what the NSA is doing. Right. It's the appearance of it that I think gets people a little bit upset.
And I think one of the major litmus tests of 2013 was how people discussed Edward Snowden. In decades past, someone like Edward Snowden would almost immediately be labeled a traitor for letting American secrets out into the open.
Right.
But he was embraced by not only many pockets of the country, but many politicians.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Rand Paul and others among him cheered Snowden for these revelations. And I think the country now is having that debate, and it's not only happening in Congress, but everywhere across the country.
He's called a whistleblower by this.
He's a whistleblower, right. Not a traitor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as much as we're all on Facebook and our smartphones and Twitter, as we become so interconnected politically, there are now some questions about who's really looking at us, who's surveilling us. And the NSA now, I think, is the target of much more scrutiny than it's ever had in the past.
Mm. Do you think there'll be some rewriting of the Patriot Act? I mean, the legislation that came out after September 11th?
Sure. And remember,
in the
60s and 70s, the CIA came under a lot of fire for its practices. And the NSA has always been the black box of American politics.
No such agency.
That's right.
No such
ever even existed.
NSA.
Didn't even know the budget. And now it's on 60 Minutes, and people are talking about it in coffee shops. And so I think you're going to see some scrutiny legislatively come 2014. I think the way the country's moving now with NSA is the president himself is talking about the NSA more than any other president. And when you have a major panel recommending so many changes, something's going to be taken up.
Well, it is interesting, James. So you've got three branches of government essentially weighing in. You've got the courts, you've got the executive through this panel, and then you've got Congress, some members of Congress that are sort of looking at some of this authorization.
And Congress will have to be on their toes, and they will have to go through their own processes to make sure they're evaluating this. Remember, part of the challenge is when you think about the NSA or this kind of agency is this another problem that we looked at, which is the inability sometimes for the federal government to vet its own contractors. And so when you combine what the NSA is doing and continuing to do with that kind of limitation, the limitation of a government that has not been very, very effective at vetting people and determining whether or not you should allow people to have access to the information. At the end of the day, it's quite clear that Snowden probably should not have had the access.
And he was
that
a government contractor.
And he was a contractor.
Right. I think that's so right, and that's spot on, because the discussion when I talk to my sources on Capitol Hill, it's not so much criticism of the NSA as an institution. It's about enabling Congress to have an oversight role in a way it just has not over the past few years.
Mm-hmm.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send me a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen, and we are talking about the year in politics. Let me see what that looks like. Kathy from Powelton Village has to say. Kathy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I so love your show.
Thank you so
much.
But
I do have a comment listening to your political talk today about using the term entitlements. I think semantics is so important in everyday life and including politics.
Sure.
And entitlements really means to me that somebody's getting something that they don't deserve somehow. And I think, I don't know where this term started in journalism or politics, but I think we just need to be careful about using this term over and over when we're talking about basic human services. It does remind me so much of Romney's speech that they caught on video about, you know, he just was incredulous that people would actually think that they would have food and health care and a place to live.
Well,
I would just really like Marty's comment and your guest comment.
Fair enough. Kathy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Should we come up with a different word, Robert Costa?
I think the caller's point is fair. But the New York Times, the Associated Press, for years have used the word entitlement to talk about Medicare and Social Security. But you're right. There's a new discussion in this country that maybe the term isn't appropriate. You now see newspapers and magazines using terms like government spending programs or just purely government programs. But I don't think entitlement programs has a bad connotation because people have paid taxes to be entitled to certain programs. But I understand the concern.
Well, I disagree with Robert because of what he just said, which is people have paid taxes in this country, and that's where the entitlement piece comes from. But unfortunately, in this political cycle, these last few political cycles, the term entitlement has been demonized and politicized. It does not have just a specific dictionary definition or the definition that Robert just gave, which is the way we should be thinking about it, which is people pay taxes, they work, you know, and when they're down on their luck, those tax dollars are then used to support some of the what we call the social safety net. But the entitlement term has also been racialized. And so people, when they think about entitlements now, they're thinking about certain groups of people living off the government, certain groups of people not trying to find jobs. And I think that's one of the reasons why we need to dispense with the term or really push to bring it back to its original definition.
But I think government spending proposal, I don't think that's going to cut it. I don't know. I don't know about you, Robert.
Well, I don't know how it's been racialized, but I'd be curious about your perspective on that because I understand if someone's using entitlement programs in a political way to criticize a certain demographic, of course that's inappropriate and wrong, but the word itself I don't see as having a racial.
Are you talking about welfare queens?
Yes, I think welfare queens contributes to it. I think when people sometimes when they think about big government programs, they're thinking about them supporting disproportionately people of color, which they do, right? But when I say racialized, I mean it's being used in a political way to make people stigmatize what entitlements are about. And so if you think that SNAP is all about feeding people of color who are lazy or feeding immigrants who are sort of, you know, that is a racialized way of thinking about it because the reality is, you know, SNAP supports white Americans just as well. And I don't know if this is a deliberate and a sinister attempt to do so. I think it's one of the consequences of the political discourses around entitlements.
I understand the debate over something like the words food stamps.
Right.
And when Newt Gingrich used those words in the 2012 campaign, people said that was almost a shot at a certain group, at a racial group, or just minority groups who have food stamps. But entitlements, to me, grandparents are entitlements everywhere across the spectrum. So it's food stamps, perhaps. I don't see it on entitlements.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Got a good conversation going. We have a tweet from Eric. Snowden is as much the person of the year as the Pope. This was something the Time magazine gets to decide, but would he have been on your list, do you think, Robert Costa, if you were in that room?
I like Time magazine's pick of the Pope. I think when I read the interview with Pope Francis, I'm Roman Catholic myself. And
another feel-good story of the year. Pope.
And it's not so much that he's changing doctrine, but it's who am I to judge, he asks. And I think that air of judgment is really leaving the church. That's bringing people back to the church. But Edward Snowden, just for the way he's changing American politics, probably should have been American Man of the Year, Person of the Year.
Hmm. What do you think, Jay?
Yeah, that's a little bit trickier for me. I mean, I'm not Team Snowden, so to speak, right? I feel like the information that we have access to as a public is important, and that makes his role, I think, important. But the question of whether or not he has betrayed secrets to foreign governments that do not necessarily need to have access to them has not been quite settled for me. And so I think in that sense, that makes him a tricky pick for a person of the year, whether for the nation or for globally. Love the consequences of what Snowden did, but I'm not exactly clear on the legality of it, the issues of treason and foreign governments, so on and so forth. That, to me, is still a little bit muddled.
We're looking ahead to 2014 as well. And because, Robert Costa, there are going to be midterm elections, does that mean that that is going to sort of color whatever happens during 2014?
Oh, certainly.
That's the lens that everything is going to be looked through?
Well, I mean, so we could talk about Pope Francis or Edward Snowden being persons of the year for 2013, but I think another person you have to have on the list for 2013 and certainly in 2014 is Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. The way the conservatives have been able to take over the Republican Party and battle for the soul of the Republican Party, you saw this with the defund movement that led to the shutdown. Ted Cruz has been in the Senate for less than a year. If he can pull the party in his direction as he did in 2013 in the same way, wow, it's going to be a wild 2014 midterms for the GOP.
Let me just ask you a quick follow-up for that because I haven't heard much from him in the last couple of months, so I don't know whether he'd been shut up or shut himself up or whether he's just sort of being quiet on the sidelines or Perhaps I'm not.
I think Cruz is pretty cagey. He established his conservative credibility during the shutdown. He didn't want to really make a battle over the small deal on the budget because it just was too arcane and detailed for him to make it a national cause. But definitely in 2014, if immigration comes up, if tax reform comes up, if the debt ceiling in February, look for Cruz to certainly be a force.
Mm-hmm. How do you see him, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, what Ted Cruz did this year is nothing short of amazing in a political context. I mean, he found a good alliance with some of the folk in the House of Representatives, and he was able to leverage that into an important ideological platform for himself and an important introduction of himself to the folk that matter. And I've said this before, you know, Cruz is playing a longer game in mm-hmm. terms of the presidential politics and presidential elections. He's already, as Robert said, he's established himself on the right, which means that, remember, the primary is all about not being primaried, right, especially at the presidential level. And what Cruz has done successfully in 2013 is he's established those bona fides. You're not going to be able to really question his right side political leanings and his ideological sort of fervor. And I think now what would be smart is for him to slowly start to make that long pivot back towards the middle.
He's going to stay on the right. The big battle on the Republican side in 2014, as 2016 approaches, is Chris Christie versus Ted Cruz. Where is the Republican Party moving?
Right.
Oh, and you do you? I mean, we're talking about
if they're smart, they're going to move with Christie. I'm not a big fan of Chris Christie, but he's to me a more he's in terms of presidential politics more the future. Ted Cruz, honestly, is more the future of the Republican Party at the state level, at the you know senatorial, at the representative level. Like those are the folks, especially with gerrymandered districts, money in politics. You know, the Ted Cruz brand of politics on the right will be very very favorable at certain local levels. I don't know how that plays at the national level, so I give the tip to Christie on that piece.
Well, we're almost out of time here, and Robert Costa, do you know what your first story for the Washington Post is going to be?
I think I may be coming up back to this area to cover Christie and Trenton, maybe actually doing some Christie work, so we'll see.
That's great.
So, Chris, keeping your eye on
I think my job at the Post will be not only cover Congress in 2014, but keep an eye on 2016, the players and the stories as that unfolds.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you. Always
fun
to talk to both of you. Robert Costa, thanks for joining us. And
again,
congratulations on your new job.
Congrats, Bob.
In January, he'll be joining the Washington Post as a national political reporter. And to you, James Peterson, always a pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. And he's Director of Africana Studies, Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University, a regular contributor to MSNBC and also to thegrio.com. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including Twitter, Facebook, email, archives, podcasts, satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.